Hello and welcome to the NHRA Insider Podcast powered by Speedmaster.
At the eighth mile, she's leading Bo Butner at the finish line stripe. It's Cameron Caruso for the first time. 6.592.
On this episode, we're joined by Jasmine Salinas, Bob Tasca III, and Del Worsham talking all things Nitro.
And there goes Gage Herrera. Vinny, Vidi, Vici. He came, he saw, he conquered.
Along with the guests, we recap a crazy weekend in Las Vegas at the 4-Wide Nationals.
Chad Green's out first by a bunch. They get to the finish line stripe, and it's Chad Green. 391.6 on a hole shot, a 33 line.
This is the NHRA Insider.
Into the night they go, and the wind light comes on for Doug Collada. 367.3, 334 miles an hour.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the NHRA Insider Podcast powered by Speedmaster. I'm your host, Brian Loans, and we are doing a post-Vegas episode here. We have three guests coming on the show. It's going to be a good one. Jasmine Salinas is going to talk about her early ventures in the world of Top Fuel drag racing. Following Jasmine, we will have Bob Tasca III, and then we'll have Del Worsham on. Really three unique people with three unique stories to tell so far in this season. Got a big shout out to Speedmaster, the presenting and powered by sponsor of the NHRA Insider Podcast. You can check out their line of speed parts, sprawling as it is, more than 10,000 part numbers, everything you can think of on your vehicle, your hot rod, drivetrain wise, engine wise, dress up wise, ignition wise. They have it. You can check them out at Speedmaster79.com or out of the very many outlets where their speed parts are sold. The biggest names in the distribution of speed parts carry the Speedmaster line, but you can check out specific parts at Speedmaster79.com, and they do have options for all, certainly all different makes, models, you name it. They have something for you there, so check it out. And to come back to the topic at hand, you know, this show is going to kind of traverse a couple of different parts of people's careers. Jasmine is at the very beginning of hers. You know, she's just getting going. Of course, Bob Tasca III and Del Worsham, Del, a championship level driver, has become one of the most sought after and respected crew chiefs in Nitro Funny Car Racing. And Bob is seeking his first world championship as a driver. So three unique perspectives there. And regardless of your feeling regarding 4-Wide drag racing, there's a few things that cannot be denied about the race we just finished up in Las Vegas. And the ending of this race is one of the things that cannot be undersold. It was incredible. Pro Stock Final was great, with Jed getting his first win in 4 years. And then the Nitro Funny Car Final was absolutely astonishing. It was Bob Tasca III winning on a triple hole shot. The finish line still is just wild, where you can barely see the nose of Tasca's car out, and then you see a line, just a solid three-car lineup of funny cars chasing him across the stripe. And then we go to the Top Fuel final round, where Doug Coletta is able to win that race in an absolutely squeaking fashion. It was as good as it gets in a lot of different ways when it comes to not just 4-Wide racing, but when it comes to racing in general. Like, that is the type of event that delivers on every level. Weather was great. Obviously, Vegas location is great. You know, you may not be crazy about the format, but you cannot argue against the competitive level that we saw there. So that's one of the things I'm interested in getting in the conversations with, especially with Del and Bob Tasca III. With Jasmine, I really want to get to understand kind of what her process has been to this point, and kind of get inside that helmet a little bit, which she has done a great job helping us with. You know, she's been very candid in her top end discussions when we've caught up with her in the pits, and it's been a very endearing part of that story that she's effectively taken us along for the ride with her, and it's great. So we'll have a lot more to talk to Jasmine about regarding that type of stuff here in just a little while. We're going to come and run 4-Wide again in Charlotte. It'll be the second and final time we do it this year. I don't know if it can get better than it was in Vegas. Maybe it can be a little faster, only because we ditch a lot of the elevation. Then again, it could be hot. So, you know, I think we have to take it as it comes. I've not ventured to peek at the long-term weather forecast, because I think that's pretty much pointless at this point, unless you're like a whiz-bang weather person. I don't know what to believe until I'm kind of on top of it. So we'll save those discussions for next week's show, which will be much more of a Charlotte preview, as this will be perhaps a little bit of a Vegas retrospective. The two things I'm going to talk to Bob Tasca III and Dale Worsham about are this idea of getting your car back and how far you can go before you get yourself in trouble and can't find your way home again, because these are two teams that found their way back home again. For Dale Worsham and his team, we watched that car go rounds and make trips cleanly down the racetrack in Phoenix. We watch it show up, go cleanly down the racetrack, and look very good in Vegas as well, going rounds in that scenario four wide. So there's that, and there's also the Bob Tasca story of him, you know, putting his foot down and saying, hey, slow the car down, slow it down, and then feeding it back again. So those are the dynamics we're going to be talking about with those two guests when they make their way onto the show. But just to put a final point on the Las Vegas race, it is this adjustment for all of us, even those of us that are up there yapping about it and making TV shows about it. It is a strange change of cadence. What our days look like on a normal four-wide day, what our days look like on a normal two-wide day are vastly different things. One of the other things that was a bit of a curveball at this particular event is that the qualifying sessions were run at relatively early times, basically 11:30 or noontime and 3, scheduled to be 11:30, 2:30, but with track schedule being a little bit of a floater, they were basically like noontime and 3 o'clock, and we were finding ourselves in our television side of things wrapping at, you know, 4:30 in the afternoon, which we never do. So there was that. There was the cadence of us making the show, and I think to be brutally honest, if you watched the broadcast, I hope you did. The first beginning of the first round of Top Fuel was not one of my finer moments in my illustrious still burgeoning television broadcasting career, and it is a weird adjustment to make. And by the end of the day, I found my comfort zone and found my cadence and found my trip that I make across the screen with my eyeballs. But you just do get so used to doing something one way, and even for a guy like me that has no want, desire, ability, or business to sit in a race car, I have a much larger level of respect for the deviations a driver has to deal with, because I know what the deviations that I have to deal with are, and they are of far less consequence than somebody sitting in front of or behind a 10,000 horsepower engine. So it is a thing for all of us. And then, you know, we take our act on the road to Charlotte, and it is a little bit more smooth. I think I know it is for me, just because, again, I develop over the course of a race weekend or over the course of time this kind of eyeball cadence. Where am I looking here? Where am I looking there? What am I looking for here or there? On any particular weekend, maybe I'm concentrating more on the 60-foot times of some cars. Maybe I'm concentrating more on the eighth-mile speeds of some cars. And when you just glance down, you know that you can see two numbers. That's great. But then you glance down and you're going, oh, wait a second, there's four numbers, and I should be looking at the third lane, but I'm looking at the, you know, I do the same thing the drivers do, except for me, it's just because I'm not that smart. And for them, it's because they're intense competitors that are laser focused. Long story short, I'm excited about Charlotte because of how good Vegas was. And we have some changing of faces in Charlotte. Of course, when we head back to the East Coast, we pick up some different cars than we do out on the far-flung Western races. It's going to be great. Mountain Motor Pro Stocks will be in Charlotte. Factory X will be back in Charlotte as well. So there's a lot of stuff that we're going to continue to talk about. But next week will be the Charlotte preview show. This is more of a catch-up with three big names, and I think I am done blabbering on about what a great weekend Vegas was and why, even if this isn't your favorite format of racing, you need to come experience it at least once. Do it. You don't have to leave and say, I love it now, but I do feel like for the people who say they don't like it, and I'm not invalidating your opinion, you cannot like it. That is your right as an American. But it is worth, in my opinion, the investment of going to see it, not for the spectacle of it, not for the grandiosity of it, not for the painful level of noise that exists when these things come off the starting line. And it is painful. But so you can appreciate when the drivers talk about things being different, when competitors, when team, whoever's talking about it, even a lunkhead like me talking about how things are different. I think there is value in coming to witness it and experience it, if only because of the difference in the entire event cadence. And it may make you like it less. It may make you hate it more, however you want to use that perspective. But you can at least say you experienced it. and I'm not trying to sell you a ticket here, but the show is as good as it gets. If it's not your thing four wide, you can at least say that you lived through it. And you go, okay, now I understand why the drivers get a little thrown off by this. Now I understand why this, that, or the other thing. Because if you're a dyed-in-the-wool drag racing fan, which if you're listening to this, I'm sure you are, you too probably struggle a little bit on some of this stuff. And it's for all of us. So yeah, I think it's definitely worth coming to check out at least once. You got two shots a year to do it. If you're an East Coaster, you go to Charlotte. If you're West Coaster, you go to Vegas. Two of the greatest drag strips on the planet. So there is that whole element of it as well. Where these races are held are jaw-droppingly beautiful places. So there you have it. When we come back on this episode of the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster, we will talk to brand newly minted rookie Top Fuel driver Jasmine Salinas about her journey into the seat, which came more abruptly than expected, but has been going along very well in the eyes of so many, myself included. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the NHRA Insider, presented by Speedmaster. We have our first guest on the show this week, and she has been making a big splash in the world of Top Fuel drag racing, not necessarily out of the blue, but certainly not on the planned schedule. Jasmine Salinas, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and it's great to catch up with you. And I was resisting the urge to hit you up like right after the first race, because I wanted a couple of these things to go down and then kind of get your impression on where you're at. And I guess the first thing I'm going to say is, from my perspective, and I think the perspective of many others, it's been really neat to watch you progress very quickly in the seat of that race car.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. I am actually kind of glad that we're doing this now, where I'm now my third race in versus right after Pomona. Because I think my thoughts on everything probably would have been like very different. But, it's been super exciting. Every single, time I'm in that car, I feel like I'm progressing so, so much and learning so much. And, I still know I have so much more to learn, but I think that's what's like making it really exciting for me is, I feel like I accomplished a good amount in top alcohol. And, now that I'm in something where I think from the outside perspective, people might think that Top Fuel and Top Alcohol Dragster are, they might not think that they're that different, but now that I'm really kind of getting into it, I honestly believe it's a whole other universe apart from each other, and it's been really exciting to see what is so different about it.
One of the things I want to talk about that's outside of the race car that's part of that universe is like a race weekend in a Top Fuel car versus a race weekend in an alcohol car. Like, your commitments beyond the race car now are exponentially larger than they ever were with the alcohol car, right? Whether it's autograph sessions, whether it's fans at the rope, all that type of stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've been all these little nuances that I know with my dad being out there, like I would see it, but watching it from the outside versus actually now this is my life is two completely different things.
Right.
But I remember being in top alcohol and, just based on where we were in the pits, if somebody came out there, they trekked, a good like 20 minutes
right, to find you
just to see you. Yeah. And now it's just nonstop flows of people all day long. And I get it. I already got to meet so many incredible people, during my time in top alcohol, but it's like every single day, it's just like everything is, magnified by like 100 times, but I'm loving it and it's keeping me busy, but I'm definitely learning how to manage and balance everything.
Do you think there's actually, when you look back on this and maybe even 5 years, maybe longer than that, when you look back at this moment in time in your life, is there a benefit, not for the circumstances of why it happened, but is there a benefit of just being thrust into this? Like, I think there are certain times when, we have stuff lined up that we're going to try to accomplish and we can almost like get in our own head too much when we overplan things. You didn't have the chance to overplan this. You basically were like, here it goes. We're starting now.
Yeah. I think yes, despite, if it could have been under different circumstances, that would have been obviously everyone's goal. But honestly, I think this was the best possible outcome of how I could have come out here.
Yeah.
I, like you said, getting in your head, and I, I think I'm a huge over planner. I will plan for things that like are probably never even going to happen. And that's probably like, it's like probably like my biggest strength and also weakness. And so this really challenged me to, you know, I had a set goal in my head of, you know, I need to do this many laps before I come out for a race. And I need to do, you know, this many test sessions and accomplish this many things. And when, you know, life doesn't work out like that, it never really does. And this is like really great moment, you know, that like proves that. And so I also think that even though I'm a big planner, I also, when I'm thrown into situations where there's a lot of pressure to just kind of show up and just figure it out, I think I also try to almost perform better too versus, you know,
you can go off script.
And so I'm really glad it happened this way, and I think it's forcing me to, not that I wouldn't have, you know, taken it seriously or stepped up, you know, but if I had the opportunity, you know, in the way I planned it later down the road. But I mean, yeah, when you're thrust into, you know, step into this car that is literally, you know, broke the first to 300
in the eight,
you
know, yeah. Like yeah, this is not a sled you're getting into. This is a fast race car. Yeah.
And you know, I think when I was planning to come out with my rookie year, you know, this year we had a, you know, maybe 5 to 6 races, and it was going to be soft launching and, you know, just working my way in. But you know, it's I think in Pomona, Rob got with me and he's like, you know, we have an idea of how many runs you need to get under your belt before we're running the car the way your dad's running it. And you know, after we just finished Monday testing in Vegas, and we just accomplished that, so we're feeling pretty confident moving forward for the rest of the season now.
And look, I think you know, Rob, I have immense respect for Rob Flynn. He's a great guy, and he's always answered every one of my dumb questions I've ever thrown at him, which makes him kind of a saintly guy in my book. But you know, I'm not sure you could be in a better position of somebody who is going to have not only your best interest but the team's best interest in mind in this process. You know, that is a guy who is not going to get ahead of himself, and he's not going to try to get you ahead of yourself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm a broken record in, you know, every article and interview, but honestly, it's everyone's complimenting me on how good I'm, you know, doing so far. But a lot of it, honestly, is the people that are around me.
Yeah.
Rob Flynn, Troy Fasching, you know, we're also lucky that he's with us. Aaron and Adam Cave, and then all of the guys that make up my dad's team. Well, I guess now my team.
Yeah, you can change you can change the tense on that. Yeah.
I'm still trying to get used to. But I mean, just I'm so fortunate that we've had a good relationship with them, that I've got to build up, you know, my working styles with them. They already have, you know, like they know how I work. They know how I drive because I did my licensing with them. And so having those little things, those are things that a lot of people don't really think about, but it just helped us kind of already jump forward when we were thrown into something that we needed to catch up in.
What the value, you know, let's talk about the test session that happened after Phoenix. You guys made 5 runs in that one day on Monday. And just from you and your own growth in the car and in the experience, what was the most valuable thing that came out of that day and those 5 runs that were compressed into it?
Yeah, I think that they're, you know, the first 2 runs that we had, they were really, really good, solid runs, really good early numbers like the car hadn't seen in a long time. But the last 3 runs that we had, they were all, I guess, you know, maybe flukes. We, you know, we shook on one, we smoked the tires early, and then we had a weird like finagle with the starter and, you know, but I always say, you know, it's like, for me personally, the runs where things don't happen the way that you want,
and
they're not perfect runs, those are where I'm learning so much,
big time.
And so, and between those 3 and then also realizing like how exhausted I was by the 3rd run, realizing I've already signed myself up for gyms when I get back to Indy. And we have a whole like workout program, because I was like, I think by like the 4th run I was secretly crying in my helmet. I'm like, I can't cry because these guys are tired, but I'm tired. And then they're like, we're doing the 5th one. And I was like, oh,
awesome.
Okay. Yeah. But it was really good. I don't know if I've even done 5 runs and hits in a day. And so it's good. It's showing me, you know, even just my body, you know, like what I need to do as an individual to really step up to be able to drive these cars and, you know, have the endurance and energy. Cause it's, you know, in ACE, you can work out if you want to. You don't have to. A lot of people don't, honestly, and you get by with it. And I Top Fuel is definitely not like that.
It is, like you said, it is part of that next level, that next universe you mentioned. And and I think you bring up a really great point there that gets lost by a lot of people that even follow the sport, that it's like, if you truly want to succeed at the level you're at now, it is a 7-day a week job.
Yes. Yeah. And I think something that I'm noticing too, now that I'm stepping into the car, is, you know, I'm very fortunate and privileged that, you know, this is something that is, you know,
absolutely
my day-to-day job. My dad, you know, him and my parents and my sisters run multiple businesses back home. And then he comes and, you know, races, and this is a second full-time thing. And for me, you know, my goal with getting myself to where I need to be is I'm looking at other drivers out here where, you know, like, I mean, in addition, you know, to, you know, running the race teams and stuff, but really, like, this is their, you know, day-to-day job, 7 days a week. And when you have people out there where, you know, they're working out every single day, you know, their diets and everything, they're taking everything in consideration, taking it seriously. It's like, if you want to compete with those people that make this their everyday life, it's like, that's what I have to do. And so it's been a really good learning curve and kind of giving me like a path of showing what I need to really step up in and do.
You know, I think one of the things that I remember witnessing in your career, and it was not necessarily a private moment, but it was the first indication that I knew when I saw how fiery you were and how intense you were in this moment. I'm like, oh, this is somebody who's going to succeed at this by hook or by crook. And it was at the U.S. Nationals. You guys are running the A fuel car. It was running exceptionally well, and the front end broke in the car when you were backing up from the burnout. And you came out of that thing and you were hot. I mean, you were hot, and you were, and off you went. And I thought, the one thing I took away from that was, like, it wasn't good what happened, but I thought to myself, this is a competitor, right? This is not somebody who just went, ah, shucks, and we're going to go ahead. Because I believe that time you had the fastest car on the property, like all the planets were kind of lined up. So I guess I'm taking a long way to get there, but that person is still there, right? But but the expectation right off the bat, that person isn't necessarily present with you right now, right? You need more experience to have that level of intensity at this point, or is it like that now?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's moments where it's like, it's definitely shown up in, you know, testing, like when we smoke early or we shake, and I'm at the top end, and I'm definitely a little more composed and conscious of that.
Yeah.
but you know, I do definitely get mad. And I know, like, some of the guys on the team, you know, they're like, you know, it's okay, it's fine, we're learning. I'm like, no, like, every time we show up to the lane, it costs us money. You know, every time, you know, you guys, you're spending how many, you know, minutes and hours putting together the car. And I think, you know, having been able to kind of step into, you know, helping learn more about managing the race team with my dad last year, I'm really learning, like the, everything costs money, everything costs time, and everybody dedicates so much time. And so when we have little things where, you know, we smoke the tires, and like, I know we need the data, I know we need the run so that we can make the car go faster, you know, it's there. But I think, you know, once I get my confidence a little more in the Top Fuel car, and then the car and I are kind of aligned, you know, I think it'll be showing up. Not sure how it'll be showing up, but, you know, I think it's exciting because I was never really been that competitive before. And I think that was the first time in my life that year where I started to see, like, hey, I can be competitive, and it's okay to be competitive, and, you know, like, really, really care about what we're doing and trying to achieve.
And I asked this question just because I don't know the answer to it, but, like, when you're growing up, when you're a kid, were you an athlete? Did you play any sports? Was that part of your life?
I tried out for so many sports and it was like always told no. I tried to do like track in high school, and then like the coach like stopped me mid running. He's like, I'm going to take you somewhere where you're going to be a winner, and like put me with like long distance.
Okay.
And I was like the last to finish every single time. Like, I'm pretty sure they like started a whole like another event while I was still running. I did volleyball and I sat on the bench. So no, I've never been competitive. I've never been athletic. I never did anything really like sports wise. Yeah. And then, you know, we also lived, you know, anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours away from our schools. And we were really just commuter kids. And then anytime we were done with school, we would just go straight to where my parents were and either did our homework at our work or just helped out in the office. And so I think there's a lot of kids and people out here that are racing and, you know, they have that competitive edge and they understand, you know, teamwork and all these things. And it was a lot that I really had to catch up on, but learned through Top Alcohol Dragster.
See, that's fascinating to me. That's great. That's a neat element to this story for me, because it's like you found this within yourself. Like you obviously were passionate about what you're doing and you were enjoying what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, you know, that switch flipped for you. And it's like, no, I'm ready to go in here and kick some ass. You know, this is a different kind of thing. And that's one of the reasons when I was bracket racing with my dad back in the day, I was getting beat pillar to post because I was just happy to be at the racetrack. I was like, oh, this is cool. This is a cool car and everything. And these other people showed up to win the race. And I think that's a really neat thing that you discovered that through this sport. I mean, that's kind of unique, I think, and cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also very, I mean, my whole life, I'm still getting a little better and drag racing's helped, but I've always been incredibly shy and incredibly introverted.
You picked the right job then. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's, you'd think I'd probably, you know, just avoid anything to what I'm doing today, but it's like, it's really helped me, you know, come out of my shell and like grow my comfort level of talking to people and, you know, it's a lot easier to talk to people when, you know, there's an equally shared passion and, you know, drag racing is like the shared common denominator, or having Stevie, my dog, out is another great, like,
absolutely. He's his own star. The dog is he's his own rock star dog. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, it's been really exciting. I think I'm trying to think back a lot lately to, you know, when I first started kind of coming out racing and thinking about who I was then and who I am now, and then thinking about who I'm going to grow into. And it's exciting because you don't really know.
It's great. And I guess the last kind of question I wanted to ask you is, you know, we've seen this progression over the first handful of races. We're going to kind of probably look at this year and some chapters for you. And when do you think chapter one closes and chapter two begins of this season for you, in terms of whether it's the tune-up of the car, whether it's your comfort level in the seat? How do you look at this year progressing for yourself?
I think this last test session in Vegas was really, really good on Monday. We did three hits. Again, you know, our numbers with the cars are really good. I'm, you know, now experiencing the next, you know, kind of level of what speed is. And I'm learning there's still so many more.
It's like, but wait, it's like an infomercial, but wait, there's more than that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I don't really know. You know, I think a lot of it will honestly fall onto me.
Yeah.
Me being, you know, so new, I think we are leaving, you know, I'm not including any licensing laps, but as of this year in my dad's car, I currently now have 19 hits.
Yeah.
In the car, you know, and now we're running with people who've been doing this, you know, maybe as long as I've been alive.
Right.
So it's hard for me to kind of, I know I have these personal goals in my head of and expectations of myself of where I need to be at certain points in the year. Our team goal is we expect to be competing for the championship. We expect to be running in the countdown. We expect to be winning races within the next, you know, couple months. So it's nothing as scrappers racing. My dad's expectations, Rob's expectations, none of it has changed. We still know we have one of the most competitive cars, and now it's up to me to fast track everything and make sure that we can achieve those goals.
Well, Jasmine, it's been great to catch up with you. It's been an incredibly compelling story to watch. It's been a very interesting story to watch. Your candor throughout this whole thing has been really great. You know, I find, and we often talk, you know, when we break for the day, we go off to dinner and we're having our conversations about stuff. Your name comes up in our conversations, and it's like in a great way, because you've been very forthright with us, and you've taken a lot of us. You've taken everybody that watches our shows on this trip with you. And I think that's a really cool thing. And there's not a lot of people that would, in a great way, be as honest as you've been and as forthright as you've been. So don't ever stop that. It's a great part of what you're doing. And it makes it really a very connective story for the viewer at home and even for us in the sport to watch.
That makes me happy to hear. I was a little nervous. I'm like, maybe Jasmine, don't say that. But it's just, it's such a wild, wild ride. And I'm just so grateful to be doing this. And I'm so grateful that, you know, I have a lot of people supporting me and cheering me on.
Well, we'll see you in Charlotte for the second and final four wide race of the year. What's your opinion on that? Did you like the first one? Are you glad there's only two of them?
Yes.
You and me both. That's fine. We share the same sentiment on that.
Yeah, okay, good.
She's Jasmine Salinas. We'll be right back here in the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster, with our second guest, Bob Tasker III. Welcome back to this episode of the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster. I'm joined by the guy who dominated the Las Vegas 4-Wide Nationals in his Ford BG Mustang, Bob Tasker III. How you doing, man?
Very good. Brian, how you doing? I don't know if dominating is the right word, but we came away with the trophy. That we did.
It was an incredible final round. It is in, with no kind of hyperbole, one of the great funny car final rounds in NHRA history. I mean, really was incredible.
Yeah, you know, and I think everyone felt it. I mean, you go up to the line, Ford, Dodge, Chevy, Toyota. You got arguably some of the best drivers in the class over the last several years. And it was game time. You know, I said to Aaron and Todd, I said, listen, put me in a position to win. I'm going to get up for it. And it was a great outcome. But I'm also humbled to say, if you ran that race 10 times, you'd have a variety of different winners. You know what I mean? It's just, in that moment, we came out on top, and it was a great win for Ford and our sponsors, and certainly for our team.
So kind of the theme of this episode is like command and control, because I had Jasmine Salinas on as the first guest, and she's kind of learning to control a top fuel dragster. She's learning all that stuff. Del Worsham is going to be the final guest on the show, and he's a guy who got his race car kind of back under his own command. And you kind of fit both of these bills. That's why I'm putting you in the middle. As a team owner and as a driver, you have to have all these elements. And I want to talk about that command element to start with, because, you know, you were very vocal at the start of the weekend. You said, hey, listen, like, we got together and kind of came to a truce here and decided we need to slow things down before we try to speed up again. Is that a conversation that happens Friday? Does it happen Wednesday? Does it happen when you leave the last race? Talk to me about the genesis of the strategy you had coming in.
Yeah, I mean, well, first off, I can tell you, I've never had a relationship with crew chiefs like I have with Todd and Aaron. I just so fortunate to have them on our program. But I went up to him Friday morning. I said, fellas, like, I'm good if I qualify 5th, 6th, or 7th. Like, I think sometimes they have so much pressure. We all do, Brian. I mean, tell you as a commentator, right? We have to perform.
Yep.
We got to bring our A game. And it's like they don't ever want to disappoint me. And I love him for that. But I said, boys, it's like, let's just go down the track. Let's just pretend we're out here running and ain't nobody watching. And we just got to go make four runs. Like, we have to make four runs. And that was the mindset on Friday. And, you know, we run low ET. It's like, wow, all right. And then, you know, Saturday we go up and down the track. You know, Sunday we knew we had a really good shot of winning the first quad. The second quad, I went up to him. I said, listen, I don't want to outrun Proc. Like, literally, fellas, let's pretend we're racing like three of the four.
Yeah, right.
Let's not go out there and press. I mean, we know we got a car as good as him.
Yeah.
But we don't have to show it. And that's one of the advantages with the four wide.
Absolutely.
And we did that was exactly our strategy. And then in the final round, I said, okay, let it eat. Like, now take the gloves off. Give it everything you got. It actually put a hole out of 800 feet, believe it or not. We are a 7 still in the race car, and we won it. But the bottom line is we executed a strategy. You know, I kind of joked. I put limiters on them. I didn't put any limiters on them. If anything, I said to him, listen, there's no pressure here. And it was great. It was a great day, great weekend. We were back out there at 7 o'clock Monday morning, and we made some great test runs, just trying to get better.
And look, and a selfish side note, like when a guy like you says something like that at the top end, it gives us, making the show, a great storyline to follow, right? Because otherwise we just have to guess. We have to say, okay, it looks like this is what they're trying to do. But when somebody actually tells us something, it's like, cool, now we can actually gauge the results of this. And damn it, the results were a win. So it kind of worked out all around. You know, I want to talk a little bit about that idea that the numbers support it, your performance supports it, but, you know, when we talk about the two best cars in the class, it really is you and Austin Proc at this point. And you really can't argue that fact. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, no, hey, listen, you know, when we hit it right and Austin hits it right, we seem to have a pretty good lead on the field. But, you know, everyone's saying the Big Four, I say the Big Ten. I mean, like, like we don't, I don't look at any of the Big Four differently. I mean, like, John Todd, I mean, he's as good as anyone out there.
Yep.
So, you know, you just got to, you got to put yourself in a position to win. And that's what I preach to my team. And if you do that consistently enough, you're going to take your licks along the way, and you're going to give a few licks along the way. And the bottom line, the way the NHRA has you know, concocted the series is, come the championship run, points reset, arguably the top 10 cars all have a real legitimate shot to win.
Yeah.
The conditions get good, and that's when you start to separate out the players to the non-players, because the harsh reality is a lot of guys can win in the summer. Ain't a lot of guys are going to win on an 85-degree track
right.
when we race in Charlotte and Vegas. It's just that's just the case. If you can't run low 80s, if you can't run mid 80s, like fall out of a tree, you're going to have a hard time winning those last three or four races in the countdown. And I think that's where, you know, people talk about the Big Four. That's where that pitcher and who they'll be this year, you know, you get an idea, but you never know. That's when that picture gets real clear. So I've always said, come out strong, survive the summer, and then go try to win the championship.
Were the goals on Monday different than the goals for the weekend? Like when you went out there and tested, was this an exploratory style of test, or is this more of a continue on a theme type of a test?
No, this is I have two crew chiefs that are completely and totally obsessed with horsepower. And they just decide to change everything. Like literally, let's just go with this fuel setup, this set of heads, this manifold, these valves. I said to Aaron, and the car ran lights out. I said, Aaron, you guys are serious about this? Yeah. I said, you understand we ran 341 miles an hour. He goes, but Bob, who's to say with this setup we wouldn't run 344? So I love their aggression. I think they're both certifiably out of their minds. That's why I love them. But yeah, they're contemplating completely gutting our race car, coming out with something totally different. And I think that if we do it, which I don't know if we will, that's their decision. You got to do it now because once three races from now, you got to be able to go back to a you know, a baseline. But the bottom line is, if you're not trying, and when, listen, I'm blessed with the funding from PPG, Ford, BG, to be able to literally have the money to buy the parts, to have these kind of options. But the bottom line is, if you're not trying, if you're not pressing, if you're not changing, you're going backwards. Because I can assure you that John Force Camp, the Coletta Camp, Hagen, Caps, these guys, they're all trying to get better. And that's what my guys are obsessed with, is to try to get better.
Yeah, and that is ultimately what's driven this sport forward for the last umpteen, you know, decades and generations. You mentioned speed, and that is still a factor in that. We look at the ETs on the weekend as a grouping of one thing, but, man, your car still had a significant speed number over the rest of the field over a couple of those qualifying rounds.
Yeah, no, we the car runs big speed, and speed is horsepower. That's the bottom line, and, you know, what you see is when you see the cars run big speed and maybe the ETs off, we just were conservative through the middle.
Yeah.
And then when the clutch locks up and the car starts showing you the horsepower in that last 50 feet, you see the speed. And that's Aaron Brooks and Todd O'Kahara. It's a dragster mentality. These guys, you know, they have to make big power when you run a dragster, and they brought a lot of that thinking over to this funny car. And the bottom line is, I told these guys, I said, listen, we probably only got one or two more races before it gets real hot.
Right.
I want to go 340 at a national event. And they laughed. They said, listen, we're looking at 344. I said, okay, just get me 340.
Right, you'll take 340 is the number. Anything else is gravy on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Ford. Obviously, you guys and your family have been intrinsically linked there. But I think you know, Jim Farley, who operates the company, became a guy who is lodged in the hearts of so many of us when just a couple of months ago we talked about the fact that, listen, this is a company that's going to make V8 engines until you can't make engines anymore. And I think, you know, for me as a drag racing fan, for people out there who love muscle cars, whether it's Mustang or whatever, that was a pretty big statement. I'm sure it probably helped buoy you at the dealership as well.
Well, listen, I love the guy. I mean, you know, maybe I'm a little biased. I know him so well. He is so aggressive. He's got such a great perspective on the business. He doesn't believe in the Tesla one shoe fit all,
yeah.
right?
I mean,
we can't turn our back to electrification, but we're not going to turn our back on the gas engine. And for Jim to make that statement, it shows his commitment in the brute force horsepower that these V8 engines are going to make. They renewed my contract. It shows his commitment in NHRA drag racing. The millions of fans that, you know, they're just gas running through their veins, right?
Yeah.
But in the same breath, as a Ford dealer, I get to sell electric, hybrid, and gas. And Jim is going to make sure at Ford Motor Company we have competitive offerings in each segment and not sacrificing, you know, what got us to the dance. And that's the ICE engine. And he's done a great job, I think, balancing that, which is not an easy balancing act, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah.
And then on the racing side, you know, you're starting to see, like, you're going to see Ford performance on my car, like you did in Pomona. And what Jim has realized is, you take the Red Bull strategy, Ford performance is a brand. It is an iconic brand. It brings intrinsic value to Ford Motor Company. If you see that Dark Horse Ford Performance Mustang livery, it's 16 races this year, Brian. We're going to showcase that Ford livery.
And that's huge. It's huge. I mean, this is a company that, you know, back the Ford, the famous total performance era of Ford back in the 60s, when they went out there and just committed themselves to literally every form of racing that existed. And so that idea to me, and I think it's important, I just, you know, I'm not even being self-serving, I look at a sport like ours. We mentioned it a moment ago, but the final round that saw four different makes of vehicles in that final round, OEM support is still very important in auto racing at a professional level, and the commitment Ford shown is really above and beyond. It is neck and neck with Toyota. I have to give Toyota credit because they do a very good job in our sport as well. But yeah, it's huge, and I know that for you it's more than simply just lip service. It is a passion.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't do it without them. It's not just the money, Brian, that these always bring. It's the engineering.
Yeah.
You know, you can't put a price tag on that. The aerodynamic engineering that Ford has put into the car, the engineering that they give us, whether it's in the clutch or the engine, I mean, I don't even value that. I couldn't value it, right?
Yes.
Those engineers. So, no, it's a privilege for me to be able to represent Ford, the fans, the dealers, the employees. I mean, I was born and raised in a Ford dealership, so it goes well beyond a sponsorship for me. I mean, I get phone calls and text messages from Edsel Ford, Henry Ford III, Jim Farley, Elena Ford. I mean, they are all, you know, fully behind what we do. It's exciting to give them a race car that they can share about.
So let's talk about Charlotte for a minute before I let you go. Obviously, we come back in the four-wide format, but also, you know, this surface is a little bit different than Vegas, right? The surface at Z-Max has been an interesting kind of thing over the years. It's had its moments of greatness. It's had its moments when the whole thing's been torn out again. So I guess if we rank the two, it's obviously smooth, but is it as fast as Vegas?
Yeah, I think it is, Brian, because when they tore it out and redid it, it's so smooth. And provided we don't get weather and rain, that always throws a monkey wrench and everything. But if the weather is comparable, I think it's actually better, only because the air
elevation.
Better.
Yeah.
If the elevation is better, the cars will make more power, the traction will be good. I haven't looked out that far to see what the forecast
Neither
is.
Neither
have I. But I'm afraid to sometimes with the way this weather changes. But the bottom line is, the Bruton Smith family, you know, the Smith family, they've given us incredible surfaces to race on. And that Charlotte C-Max strip, man, if the conditions are right, hang on, because it'll be, you know, record-setting conditions.
Well, man, it's great to catch up with you. Congratulations on your first win of the season, and the way things are going, it does not look like it's going to be the last. And certainly, you know, the face of Funny Car is different this year in a few ways. Austin Proc coming in has certainly done a lot for the class, but we've looked at JR winning, we've looked at Bob Tasca winning, we've looked at some of the guys that have been dominant, still kind of figuring their stuff out. So
don't forget that guy. I think they call him John Force winning. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
We ain't doing too shabby, I tell you. No, it's exciting to see John, you know, out there. Just really remarkable. No, it's going to be a fun season. You're going to give you and Tony a whole lot to talk about.
Bob Tasca III, thank you very much, man. It's fitting to talk to this guy on the birthday of the Mustang. It all ties up together, man. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, brother. Talk to you later. Bye.
When we come back, we'll have Del Worsham, the crew chief of the Bendero Premium Tequila GR Supra, as our next guest. And we are back here on the NHRA Insider Podcast, powered by Speedmaster. We have Del Worsham on the phone right now, catching up with Del because they got their race car back, and I want to find out how they did it. What's going on, man?
Just taking it all in, man. I've just been analyzing data and kind of taking in the last couple races and just seeing love.
You know, I think what's really interesting is we can sometimes see teams, and it happens to everybody, that they kind of go down a blind alley and it takes them a long time to fight their way out of it. But you guys were able to kind of contain your issue and get it turned around relatively quick.
Yeah, you know, I kind of think this whole thing started back after the Las Vegas event in the fall. And we went to Pomona, and I had this great grand plan of going there and driving a car and her driving a car and racing each other. And it just did not play out at all the way I thought it would.
Yeah.
And didn't really, you know, there's a lot of circumstances that come into play when these things happen.
Sure.
And it's easy from the outside looking in, well, you should have done that, you would have done great. Well, I didn't bring that other car to the next couple races, and it's, you know, it still didn't do much. So
right.
it really had some problems and some stuff that had to get worked out on it that I guess I just kind of missed it, or I didn't really know 100% what was going on. And also, you know, they were just kind of outplayed. So
can these things kind of lie to you in a certain sense? Like, can you look at all the data that you have access to and think you kind of got something pinpointed, and as it turns out, it's in another direction?
No, absolutely, absolutely. There's so many parts and so many variables that go into this, and it doesn't take much to get the thing off. And then as soon as you're off a little bit and you don't have a lot of confidence and you start maybe running scared or doing things you shouldn't do, then you have weather comes into play, like Pomona,
right,
or you lose runs. So now you're on cold tracks, running it like maybe a little bit scared so that it does things it shouldn't do. Or when you know you need to go out there and do it and it rips the tires off, you don't know why. There's mechanical issues on top of that. So it's just one thing after another, you know. After Pomona, I was pretty discouraged after Pomona.
Yeah.
I really was. And we went to dinner Sunday night, and I went, the whole entire team went, and John Paul DeJoy is with us, and he wanted to go to dinner, and he got everybody together, and he made a little speech, and he was, you know, he's a very positive and motivating guy. And he said, look, I'm good with what's going on right now. He goes, and I pay the bill, so that's that.
Right.
No problems there. And then he says, remember, it's not how the horse starts a race, it's how the horse finishes the race. And that's where we're going to be when we need to be there. And I felt a lot better about that. So I packed up the team, and off to Bakersfield we go between Pomona and Vegas. And we spent a whole day testing there. And I felt pretty good about going into Phoenix after a day of testing. Alexis couldn't make it to drive. She had prior commitments. So I hired Jeff Arin to come back in again and drive it for the day. And I felt, man, okay, I felt good. We're doing better. We have something to work off here. And we go to Phoenix the first day, and it's just absolutely awful. It's the same crap that went on Pomona, the two Pomonas. And I just, like, I felt like crying, you know. I'm not going to lie. It was very disheartening. And I was pretty down on myself. And my wife, you know, she's like, hey, you know what you're doing. Just stick with us and stick to your plan, and this will work out. And again, we get into Q3 over there. Well, Q2, I guess, because only three runs. And again, it's just doing bizarre stuff. So finally, Q4, we pulled back so far that I wasn't sure if it was even going to be fast enough to qualify.
Yeah.
And it goes down the track, and it drops the cylinder and runs a 4.13. And I got to tell you, in all my years running a 4.13, which since we found delayed back headers, a 4.13 is not a real representable run of what we can do. But it was one of the nicest sights I've seen in a long time. And took that run, you know, and pretty much just started chopping 400s off at a run, you know. So it went 13, it went 10, it went 404, four, and then once it got kind of in that area, we just kind of let it be for then and let that kind of be our number so we didn't do anything stupid. But it wasn't any one, you know, I can't say, you know, I went out and bought a magic clutch disc or I bought a magic tune-up or something was like wrong. There were a lot of things that were wrong. A lot of them were the decisions I was making, you know, at that time. That same decision, you know, I guess you could take out other times and it just goes, but right then it wasn't going. So something had to be changed.
How satisfying was the moment when you realized, like, you fed it the extra 400s and it picked up the 400s? Is that just when the weight kind of comes off? Because it's one thing to get it down there, but then all of a sudden the thing actually starts to respond. I have to imagine that's the moment where you can kind of say, okay, I'll be able to sleep tonight.
A little bit, but, you know, it's still a tenth behind.
Yeah.
Or I was off a serious 500s to a tenth, but that was kind of our range right then, and we know how to get it back into like a quicker car, but smoking the tires was absolutely not an option. I'm like, you know what? Let's just go up and down the racetrack and just see if other people make bigger mistakes than us. And it happened all day until the final. And sometimes it works that way for you. But then we went to Las Vegas and I was just bound and determined to not be that far behind in Las Vegas. The first run, we kind of left it alone and it ran similar to Phoenix. It ran 406, which I don't believe it was an okay run, but it's not representable of what this team can do. And then we talked about little things that happen to you or little things that do. So we had made so many changes to make it run those 4.0s that on the second run in Las Vegas, it was on a great run, but it broke a piston. It shut off and ran 4.03 at like 270. Well, if you look at it, you know, we got over a little time charts wherever he's running. Well, now we're up in the top five. It just hasn't been popped up on the scoreboard yet, but it's a much better run. It broke a piston, pan pressure shut it off. Well, it was just so lean and everything hadn't been brought back to where it needed to be to make those kinds of runs that the tune-up was still just off a little bit, but you could tell it was definitely improving.
Yeah, and that's neat. I mean, that to me is the neat, you know, that idea that, you know, these decisions all are kind of compounded on each other. And when you have to start untying these knots and get it back to where you want it, you have to be as systematic making those changes as you were to get to the place you were at in the first place. I find that to be a very interesting part of the whole, you know, part of your job and every other crew chief's job is like, it's so much more than simply like, well, we'll just try this on this run. I mean, it really is an entire system of things that go to add up to make any sort of performance.
No, it does, you know, so now we're in Las Vegas and, you know, I mean, I guess your initial thought is, hey, just put all the fuel volume back in and you put the clutch on it. It'll be fine. Well, you're still in altitude. And you're still on a 130-degree track, so it's not that easy, you know, to just blast all this fuel at it. And if you drop a cylinder, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be the same. You're not getting the results you want either. But I didn't expect it to break a piston, but it did. So either way, that's that. Then comes Q3, and it leaves Q3, and it's running great again, and out goes a cylinder. And I'm like, what? So it goes one run, it breaks a piston. It goes the next run. Now a cylinder's out. Well, It shot a spark plug out of it, which has kind of been an epidemic going around.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've heard a lot of this, man. That's crazy.
I know. And so it shoots a spark plug out of number five, which is the same cylinder that broke the piston the run before. That's the one that dropped now. So at first I'm like checking jets and then like, well, it blew a spark plug out. And I'm like, all right, that's that. But it still ran a 396, which was a representable run, you know, but at 2.5 seconds, it's on seven cylinders and runs 396. So the clutch is better now. The fuel system looks right. We just need the parts to be right. And Q4, I think it smoked the tires Q4. And I don't exactly know why. Yeah. Because it really hadn't smoked the tires since Phoenix, you know, on Friday.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what that was about. But whatever. So it did that. But kind of blew that off for race day. It didn't blow out any spark plugs. It had the right fuel system in it. Yeah. It had the right clutch on it. And a 394 popped up on the board. And the motor looked great. And kind of left it alone, made me a couple of adjustments for the next run, and picked up the 393, which was, it wasn't a winning run, but it was a representable run, and it's closer to where this team should be and where we are. And it was, I'm going to tell you, it was not easy. And there were times I wanted to cry, and there were times I wanted to puke, and there's times I wanted to hug everybody. So here we are.
Yeah, I mean, you probably also wanted to take a blowtorch to the thing at a couple of times, too.
I don't know if they have it on film, but when it either shook or smoked the tires in Phoenix one of the runs, I flipped that car double bird right there on the starting line. And I don't think, I didn't know I did it at first. And then I caught myself with my fingers in the air, and I'm like, oh my goodness, this is no way to end the team. So, but that was just the emotional state I was at that point. And there, you know, I'd move weight around on the car, trying to make it, trying to change the balance, thinking it was going to be better. And in the end, we ended up right back where we always were. And she drove the car well and went straight and made good runs on Sunday. And I'm really, really, really looking forward to Charlotte. We've had lots of success. I have myself and she has, and we've been to the final there, and it's a pretty good race for us. So I would really be bummed if we didn't go into Charlotte and put up another good race.
And one last thing I want to just clarify for people that are listening. When we talk about blowing a spark plug out, I want people to understand what this actually means, because I think the common conception might be, oh, well, it means it blew the spark out of the plug. No, we're not talking about that. No. We're talking about physical damage. So if you can explain to the viewer at home, what does it mean when we talk about blowing a spark plug out? What are you saying?
Okay, so the spark plugs we run are similar or just near identical to the ones you run in a passenger car. So you have the body, and then you have the porcelain. Then the porcelain's crimped on there, and it holds it in there, and you put the spark plug on there. Well, it blows the porcelain right out of the center of the plug and blows the spark plug right off, and there's basically a hole going through the spark plug with no spark. So the threads are all there. It's just the plug itself blows apart, and I'm not exactly sure. You know, we've been through this on and off for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Whether it's manufacturing or it's the tune-up or it's the crimp or who knows, but there's ways to check it, and we just need to be a little more probably a little more, just pay attention a little more and see if we can find some of these problems.
And yeah, and we're really, it's a function, it would seem anyway, like from hourly, it's like a function of the insane cylinder pressures that are running these cars, like the amount of pressure pushing up on that plug to actually basically blow the center of it right out is just bonkers.
Oh yeah, no, it's exactly right. It's a lot, and that's pretty much the gist of it. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of parts of this car, and they all have to be right. And if one's wrong, it doesn't work. So basically, you have to be perfect all the time. And if you're not perfect all the time, it'll show, and you'll pay the price for it.
Well, man, I appreciate you taking some time out of the day. I wanted to dive in there and kind of get some insight from you about the turnaround that you guys made, because it was, again, from my position, it's always interesting to watch when we start to see the incremental progress, and then by the end of Vegas, we see a car that's running, you know, really where it should be to be competitive. So congrats on being able to get some sleep between now and Charlotte.
Yeah. Well, and like everybody says, you know, I mean, it was the team. It was a lot of hard work. It was testing. It was going through everything we own and making sure that, you know, all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted. And when everything was in place and we had everything right and I had it tuned right and it was assembled right, then the results are still there. So I appreciate it and look forward to some good races coming up.
He's Del Worsham, and I'll be back with some final thoughts in this episode of the NHRA Insider powered by Speedmaster right after this. And we have reached the end of this episode of the NHRA Insider podcast powered by Speedmaster. Check them out online. Speedmaster79.com is their website, but you can also see their products sold at every major speed parts vendor you can think of. If you're building a project, if you're improving your project, Speedmaster likely has what you need at a right price to make those changes to your race car, to your street car, to your hot rod, whatever you're working on. Check them out at Speedmaster79.com to see the entire listing of parts, somewhere more north of 10,000 part numbers the company has. We will be back next week with a pre-Charlotte episode. Obviously, we're going back-to-back four-wide drag racing in the world of NHRA Mission Foods competition, so we'll keep up that theme. Been a great conversation with Jasmine, with Bob, and of course with Dell to kind of round things out. Hope you enjoyed this show. I've certainly enjoyed making it. I'll see you right back here next week at the NHRA Insider podcast powered by Speedmaster.